Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from The Grave Talks. If you're liking this program, I invite you to become a grave keeper. That is a supporter of this program. You are the folks who will financially allow this show to continue going forward. $5 a month gets you access to advanced episodes of the show as I create them. Typically 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes even more episodes in advance, available exclusively for our grave keeper members. Plus, exclusive interview segments that are not going to be available to the public, only to gravekeepers. Typically an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes of interview time with future guests of our show going forward. It's exclusive content, it's advanced content, and it's only for gravekeepers who are helping to keep the show on the air. It takes a tremendous amount of time every single week for me to put this show together, get it up, get it on the air, have it hosted, bandwidth, all of that. And I love doing it, but we do need to make sure it's financially viable, in at least to support the costs of running this thing. So if you like the show, please consider becoming a gravekeeper through our website, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month, get advance access and exclusive content as well to keep this show on the air. Thank you for your support. I hope you enjoy it just as much as I do. Check it out, thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks. And thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the Western State Lunatic Asylum. The Western State Lunatic Asylum has been the topic of paranormal rumors and legends for decades. What are the menacing forces that live behind its walls? For over 120 years, the Western State Lunatic Asylum has been the site of medical experiments and has seen medicine and care turn from archaic to modern. The mad, the violent, and the disenfranchised of Western Kentucky were all once housed together inside its dark medical wards. Many became victims of garish experiments and arcane medical practices of another time. We discuss the stories of discarded orphans, the feeble-minded and the criminally insane, all living together in this man-made purgatory. It's these spirits that still make themselves and their torment known to the living to this day. The dark forces haunt Western State Lunatic Asylum alongside the souls of the once living. We discuss all of that and more on today's episode of The Grave Talks with our guest, Steve Asher.
If you look at the situation that we had at the time, the hospital was built right around the time of the Civil War and a little bit before. And so it was actually pretty big, you know, for this area, because up until then, everything was more toward Frankfort and Louisville and that area. And so most of the time, people were kind of relegated to being farmed off to isolated areas by themselves, or kind of kept in the back room, that type of thing. And I mean, I've heard stories of people even keeping, you know, special needs people in barns with cattle and stuff, just because maybe they had violent outbreaks or whatever, you know, choices that they are choices that they couldn't really control and that they made. They decided to put them in there. So as crazy as an asylum, you know, pardon the pun, may sound, it was a step up. And it was sort of a thing where, you know, they could have some sort of structure and some sort of way to care for the people, because a lot of times, as bad as it sounds, you know, people in that situation, especially then, there wasn't a whole lot of social catch nets. This was the one way that they could sort of be managed and not be such a hardship on the family, which more often than not was probably struggling anyway due to it being during the time of the, you know, the Civil War and all that, which Civil War actually kind of crossed lines with the asylum at one time.
Really?
Yes.
When was the asylum initially built?
If memory serves, to quote Batman, I believe it was 1854.
Oh, wow.
I believe that's when it came online. So it's actually a little bit older than the penitentiary that came online in 1889.
Okay.
I was just going to add to that. See, initially, the incarnation and the way the buildings are at the moment were not the original buildings, because initially, you know, there was a large main structure, but it was mainly, you know, wood. Mm-hmm. And there had been a very bad fire that basically raised that entire building which was set by one of the people, which is one of the stories in the book. And apparently the person said it purposely, went into a room, locked the door, they beat on it, tried to pry it open, but he'd secured it with all his furniture, and they were able to see him through the little slide, you know, observation window that they had back then. And, you know, we're begging him to open him up. I used his name as Buck, and he was just like, no, you know, my work is done. And then he just had a smile on his face as he was consumed by flames. He was the only fatality of that particular event. But as time went on, it turned into the stone structure that people know of today. And there's a lot of different little buildings because it's in its modern age as a hospital, not a lunatic asylum. You have drug treatment. You have a area for like a battered women's shelter, a lot of different things, a whole lot of different treatments and programs are set up there. You know, they even have like a little activities building, you know, almost like a dance hall and things like that. So a lot has changed from the early days. And even then, you know, it would be unfair for me to put it like these people necessarily were willfully trying to mistreat these people, especially at that time. Just like women's suffrage, you know, they were considered kind of second-class citizens, and it was sort of like, well, this beats better than whatever. Or some of the people just like, well, they don't feel like we do, you know. It was that kind of mentality. But, you know, there was a lot of things that happened and a lot of advancements that come through study and having these people here, which, again, beat having them out on their own, starving, possibly committing crimes to try to survive, because a lot of these people didn't have the intellect or the control factors to function in what we would consider normal society.
Let's stay on the earlier days of the asylum. Tell me about its brush with the Civil War.
Okay. I'm sure I'll get the dates wrong, so I won't even say the dates. I'll just say the situation.
Sure.
Because Kentucky is a border state, and Kentucky was conflicted as well, because, you know, it was a situation, especially the further you got toward Louisville and Cincinnati and all that, where there was more interstate commerce and trade, that was more north leaning or Union. And the further you got out in the rural areas, just like in a lot of places, it's going to be more conservative, and they were, you know, more for the Confederates. Well, the problem was, the Western Lunatic Asylum was considered a state facility, but they would be like whenever they'd have to get supplies, because, you know, they weren't able to care for the people and grow their own food and all that stuff at the time. And anytime they would get supplies in from Frankfort or whatever, they would either be hit by Confederates, or because if they were in Western Kentucky, Union would come across and go, oh, well, this is just another rebel facility, we'll steal for them too. And they would basically take what they wanted. And it was getting to the point where it was, you know, getting very, very lean on not just the staff, but, you know, obviously the people in there getting treatment. And it come to the point where they had to kind of make an alliance. You know, it's kind of like the devil. You know, the people that come through that were Confederates, they knew of them. And there was a particular general, or not a general, but I think it was a captain. And he more or less said, look, we need a certain amount of supplies, and here's what we can do. Instead of taking everything, it's kind of a Negan deal. You know, we'll take a percentage of what we need, but we will give you protection, and we will keep your line as people are coming in and out with your stuff, keep it protected from the Yankees. I said, but you are going to have to give our men who are wounded aid, and those that can't make it home, you know, because we're in the middle of fighting, your staff will have to bury them. And that's what they did. They actually took their Confederate dead and supposedly interned them. The story is that worked out all fine, but there was obviously hard feelings and things like that being put in that position. And it was said that some of the dead were just say unceremoniously put in the ground, more or less kind of chucked in the clay, to use a Lynyrd Skynyrd term. And supposedly that there was ghost activity, or what you want to call it, you know, some sort of remnant and kind of bad mojo left from that. So It's really weird, because I never knew about anything like that kind of interaction until I actually really studied this. I mean, I know in my area, Western Kentucky, there was a lot of fighting, not so much right in my town and my county, but especially the further out where there was more trade routes and stuff coming through. Yeah. So that was just sort of a weird turn of events.
The accounts of paranormal activity. So that would almost likely, I would say, and then you tell me if I'm wrong here, would be probably some of the first accounts of paranormal activity going on at the site.
Right. Well, really the, well, you got to look at it too, is before obviously any white men were here during that time, you know, they were Native Americans and they used a lot of this land was considered sacred because it was hunting grounds and sure. things like that. I mean, and not to mention there were mounds and things built throughout Western Kentucky and in Southern Illinois, the Mississippian cultures. And so it was a hunting ground and a holy spot as well. So there was already, you know, a mystical quality to the land before it ever come down. But it seemed like as soon as they had the asylum there, not to mention they also had the county poorhouse, which, you know, I don't know if you ever had a grandma that said, you know, well, you got to start turning these lights off, boy, you're going to put me in the poorhouse. That was a real thing. That wasn't just, you know, yeah. grandma talking out of her, you know, talking out of her head. That happened. And all this stuff, all these different conflicting emotions and the confusion and sometimes just the isolation, you know, because a lot of times these people were isolated or conversely put together like a bunch of chickens in a hen just bouncing off of each other, you know. And it wasn't so much to mistreat them, it was just we got to store them some which way.
Yeah.
So either they were completely by themselves or they're just overrun with other people. It just seemed like that helped to amplify whatever, I don't want to use the term psychic resonance because it kind of sounds kind of a generic term, but just it seemed like it amped everything else up.
Sure. That's understandable. As the hospital essentially migrated into more modern times and into, you know, 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and so on, what was life like there as it got to, I don't want to say, I hesitate to say current because we're still talking about quite a while ago.
Right. Well, you know, it's a thing. I'm a big Doctor Who fan, so time, especially if you do research, time is relative, and there's things that would happen today that you tell a situation, go, oh, well, that happened in 1814, or you talk about something that sounds very barbaric, but it's today in different parts of the world, or sometimes even here in the U.S. But as times kind of advanced and there became more accreditation and more of a uniformed use of psychotherapy and also drug therapy. Obviously, in those early days, you know, it was back in the day, hey, you got a toothache here, have some cocaine. You know, here's this. Everything was like, oh, we found a miracle compound that fixes everything. Hey, you know, pregnant mothers, here, have some thalidomide to help you with this and that. And you saw what happened there. So it was very, very a test, kind of a tested as you go. And a lot of times, unfortunately, they tried out new treatments and new medicines and new therapies in penitentiaries, which is documented, and also in asylums. So sometimes things were better than they were, and sometimes they were drastically worse. You would find a lot of times you would have people being basically chemically restrained, you know, by a chemical cocktail or whatever. And sometimes it was maybe better in their eyes; they were more docile. But then also medicines build up in your body. Even, you know, if anybody, you know, has say maybe epilepsy, and they have to say take certain chemicals, certain medicines. And time, you have to watch the levels because they'll get build up in your blood and can become toxic and cause a whole lot of problems. And not to say anybody with epilepsy is mentally challenged. I'm just using that as an example. So, I mean, there was an advancement, but also, again, it was still very much a rocky road. And then by the time you get into what was maybe the 50s and the 60s when they were really using stuff like, you know, lobotomies and things like that and more like some shock treatments and different things like that. It goes to another, oh, here's this miracle cure, here's this and that. And there was just swaths of people, you know, being lobotomized. You know, people kind of look at it back at it now, you know, through our current mindset and just go, my God, look at the horrible things they did to these people. But they truly thought they were helping. But it doesn't change the fact that at least in my eyes, these people were brutalized and victimized, and, you know, really without very little choice in the matter.
Sure. Sure. How long did the hospital stay open? How far into current times was this an operational building?
It's open today.
The actual structure itself, the old structure?
Well, like I said, the original wooden building was taken down.
Okay.
And they basically had some almost huts, you know, very simple. Because like I said, this is wartime.
Yeah.
And a lot of metal and stone and things like that was used in the war efforts and whatever to fortify forts.
Okay.
You know, special needs and mentally challenged was way down on the list.
Sure.
So, but no, I mean, currently, like you said, what you have seen probably from the early to late 1900s, barring addition of different specialized buildings, mm-hmm. is kind of what you see. Okay. Because at one time, this was also a TB, had an area for TB treatment. So everyone thinks, oh, Waverly, of course, or, you know, TB. No. We had our own little thing, sure. but no one very much knew about it because it was in the shadow of this larger facility that has had a lot of hype. And for the most part, they keep it very quiet here. Bible Belt area, they're very much well, these are people getting treatment. We don't want to be talking about ghosts and goblins, and their families are already having a hard enough time knowing that they're here.
Sure.
Much less thinking that they've got spooks chasing them. So, but yeah, all that was there. And but for the most part, the facility is pretty much as it is,
as
it was.
I would just assume when I look at the pictures of the facility that this is an old abandoned building, but it, especially the older giant, you know, the stone structure. So it just struck me as almost shocking that this is still in operation, but sometimes it can be deceiving from the outside as far as what's on the inside.
Well, it's a, I don't know, maybe it's just a state, a Western Kentucky type thing. Mm-hmm. And just a southern thing, you know, we use a thing to death, and
sure.
we'll make use of a facility or a building or a structure or a tool or whatever. I mean, as many times as we can, as much as we can make use of it. You
sure.
know, we learned not to throw much away. But it's the same thing with the penitentiary. You know, you have to understand, which it's still called a penitentiary. It hasn't been changed to a, you know, correctional this or whatever, readjustment camp or whatnot. But
sure.
I mean, the way it is now. Because, like I said, you know, they would took off a lot of the screening that was on the upper floors. That is where a lot of times they would have the folks with TB, because they thought, well, fresh air, cleanse, you know, we'll take care of the disease. But, you know, a lot of it has changed, like I said, like that, because at one time you would have, it was all segregated. You would have, you know, black men on this side, white women on the, or black men or black women on another side. And then on a whole other wing, you would have white males, white females. You know, there was none of the crossing over on it, which is more or less just institutional racism, but that was par for the course and for the time. And that continued on well after, as I understand, the Civil War era.
What was the first haunting or account of a haunting that occurred there that you're aware of, that someone started talking about? There's something going on here.
Well, I mean, the first historical one was the one I mentioned where the fire was started.
Sure.
Which the person swore that he was told to do whatever he was directed by this unseen creature, more or less, you know, well, they call him Scratch or the devil or whomever.
Mm-hmm.
But you started having people reporting, of course, you know, shadows, cold spots, screams coming out of, you know, pipe cellars, things like that, where there's no one at. There have been, again, reports where they would have hydrotherapy room, which is basically where they'll put a person in a large tub, put it with lukewarm to cool water. I mean, they're not going to put them in ice, that will kill you. You'll get hypothermia and die quickly. And the same thing with warm water. They'll get it as warm as a person could stand it safely. And different things were to break different moods. It was almost a shock to the system, and it would sometimes draw people out of depression, which, you know, I mean, have you ever heard somebody like, hey, you seem really down, you need to get out in the sun a little bit, get a little, you know, vitamin D or whatever. And there was a certain truth to that, but there was a change in scenery and change in temperature that for whatever reason can kickstart changes in personality, just like, you know, people get seasonal depression during the winter and whatnot. But imagine that coupled with a mental illness. There was a story, if you want me to tell you.
Yeah.
There was this couple, and And the younger lady was more into the paranormal. The older lady in the couple, she had a kind of a dabbling interest, but not really into the occult. More like, you know, the Universal Monsters and just growing up on, you know, Dark Shadows, the entertainment side of the paranormal. So anyway, they started playing with a Ouija board. And I'm not saying that Ouija boards are necessarily bad nor good. I know some people that's used them for generations through their family and a spiritual type upbringing, and they're comfortable with it. Me, I don't like them. I don't use them. But so anyway, they're doing this and that, and they're trying some things at home, and they're getting a little bit of response. And they said, you know, it's such an old building. Why don't we just, you know, bring our little board in? It's not something that they can really hurt themselves with, but, you know, we'll just go in there and maybe find a couple little spots on our lunch breaks and just kind of play with it. You know, some people play with their phones, some people do this and that. Well, they kept it kind of quiet. They would visit little locations, maybe rooms where they were put in there for isolation, or maybe rooms they were put in there like the cafeteria, or rooms they were put in there like the laundry rooms. Well, they would get limited response. Well, the younger of the ladies said, you know, let's go try the hydrotherapy room. It's really not used anymore. It's kind of isolated. Well, she wouldn't be really disturbed. So they really did it up. You know, they started bringing it in where they have some candles, and they'd kind of do calling the four, you know, the four corners out, you know, very kind of candle magic-esque. So they started actually getting some responses, and they would ask relatively simple things, you know, and kind of give an idea of when these people were there, and slowly they started getting responses. Now, the older lady started not getting real comfortable with it, because it seemed like this thing never wanted you to leave. It was constantly like, no, don't go, stay. And it's like, I have to go. No, you won't go. And then they'd break the circle, and she's like, this thing is getting really brazen. So she was more or less like, I think we should cool it on that, you know. And the younger lady was like, well, I don't know, maybe, but I kind of like to do it. Well, I don't think it's safe. Long story short, the older lady had went to visit her sick mother, and the other lady went into work. She ended up, her mom got better. She was supposed to be gone for about a week. She got better in about 3 days. So she came on back, was going to surprise her with lunch at work. She spoke to another lady who was out on a smoke break and asked where her friend was at, and said, oh, she should be in the cafeteria. And she just had this drop in her stomach. Just her intuition just said, no. So she made a beeline to the cafeteria, found nothing. Nobody had seen her. Went back to where the hydrotherapy room was. Found the door unlocked. Walked inside. It was pitch black. Couldn't hear anything. Didn't see anybody. She started to come back, and there was another little side door that went out into a small, like a commons area where you could sit and smoke or do whatever. A couple of little break areas. And for some reason, something caught her attention. And it was kind of foggy. It was summer, you know, mid, late summer in Kentucky, and when it rains, you know, it's always foggy here. Mm-hmm. Started hearing something and started looking around and saw a figure by a tree. And at first it kind of scared her. She didn't know if it was a person that was escaping, and then heard a voice and kind of recognized it. And she went over there, and it was her girlfriend. And at first she was just sobbing, really couldn't communicate. And she was helped getting her up, and she said, well, look, she's got sick, you know, throwing up. She didn't tell her what had happened. And I said, well, here, I'm just taking her home for the night. So she took her home and said, look, what happened? She didn't want to talk about it. And just, she kind of was grilling her. It's like, look, something's going on. And she lifted her neck up, and she said, I don't know, I'm hurting so bad. And showed her neck, and it looked like something had been tied around her neck. Not like handprints, but like almost like a, like you take a piece of rope or sheet or something. And so what she told her was, she went in there, she was doing the same little thing. She was basically obsessed with it. So she's doing all this and that, and this thing keeps talking about, says, why are you still here? She said, hurt. And she's like, well, someone hurt you, so what's going on? And the more it kind of got more intense, she could kind of start feeling movement around the room, almost like something unseen was moving about her in the shadows. And she had candles, but the walls started getting very dark, almost like there was something blocking the light. And she was like, look, I'm sorry, but I gotta go, I'm not comfortable. And this thing is more or less, again, no, stay. And she's trying to close the circle, wouldn't let her close the circle. And she's trying to go to the goodbye. She felt something clench her, like from behind, lift her up off the ground. She had no idea what was going on. She was grabbing at her throat. She couldn't feel anything, but she didn't feel a physical object, but she could feel the force around her throat. Well, she's flailing around trying to get some sort of footing. She ends up kicking almost by accident, knocks the candles over. It kind of, you know, kicks the board, you know, across out of the circle. Boom. She drops to the ground. She runs out the door screaming, and she makes it to that side door because she's like just freaking out. That's the first door she could get out of. And so they said, okay, well, we're done with this. So they go to try to, you know, they're going to get it. They're going to burn it or do something with it. And she, actually the younger lady, ended up staying. The other lady came back that next morning, said, oh, well, I think she forgot her ID or something. I'll go pick it up. Went back to the hydrotherapy room. No candles, no Ouija board, no anything, but there was, the way I understand it was, I don't know if it was wet footprints or wet spots where something had been standing right around where the tub where she'd been attacked. And it didn't have any water in there. There wasn't any, nobody had ran water in there in like a long time. There was no, it wasn't like a leaky, rainy night. There shouldn't have been any reason for any sort of water or anything like that, much less the candles and all that. So after that, they pretty much gave that kind of stuff up, which to me was, because I asked them, I said, look, you know, how, like, why did you go ahead and go back? Because I said, it's almost like one of those Hollywood things where you go like, hey, don't go down there, it's waiting for you, you know. She said, like, honestly, at the time, I was so into the moment, I wasn't thinking about the risk of it. And I, it was almost like I was compelled. I mean, it's all I wanted to do. I was more or less obsessed with it. And, you know, they thought in the end they possibly could have come either possessed or overtaken by whatever forces was. I'm not saying it's a spirit or a demon or anything like that. I never make that kind of assumption. But they definitely felt that whatever it was negative and was trying to latch on to her. So that's one of the weirder ones. And that's actually in the chapter, The Dead Girl on the Talking Board.
That's, I mean, quite a story. Now, I know you said you don't necessarily go in and make the assumption of whether it was a demon or a once human spirit, but that was going to be my next question is, if you had to do that, if you had to make some assumption or they were to, the people who this happened to were to make some sort of assumptions as to what this was, is there any thought there of if this was something that is, for lack of a better term, something demonic or something that was not human, that was doing the scratching, the pushing, the overwhelming feelings?
Well, in speaking with some other people, without getting into the story, because it's one of those things you don't want to pollute the water, sure, and people just telegraph the same thing back to you. Even when I do investigations, you know, when I'm able to actually physically go on to a location, which there I was not, as it is, you know, all kinds of HIPAA laws and sure, this and that. I would just kind of go, have you guys noticed anything? And they, if it kind of coincides with what I'm kind of feeling, I will make note of it. Talking to some people, that there had been a female who, and I'm using kind of air quotes, mysteriously died. They said that supposedly it was an accident or a suicide. But then there was some other story where apparently there was another inmate. I don't know if it was a weird kind of love triangle thing or what, but supposedly she was strangled there, and it was made to look that. Again, cannot substantiate it. I have nothing proven it or disproven it, other than the story from these people that have said this is what they have heard while they worked there, and this has been something that's been spoken of for probably 20 years. So that's sort of the thing I'm working on, and that's what I always tell people. Whenever I write my stuff, first of all, I always go in it as, look, this is a work of fiction based on true encounters from people, which obviously I'll change certain details, locations, names, and stuff. But back to your original thing, do what I think it's something demonic, or do I think it was human? I said, I would have to say probably closer to being a tortured human spirit. I think a lot of times things are put on, not like, oh, those poor demons, let's give them a break. But I mean, I think sometimes people put stuff on something that's inhuman when people are pretty horrible when they want to be. They can be vastly benevolent, or they could be completely hellish. But I do think it was probably a very badly confused, tortured human, more likely human spirit that was striking out, like they were struck, you know, they were mistreated, so they wanted to hurt somebody too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and like we'd said on before in other conversations, I'm not an expert in this. I don't think there are any. And I just can only go with, like, this is what they said, this is what they saw. I do think that there are definitely negative entities out there, or forces or remnants from people. I don't think you go through a metamorphosis, you know, you die and then you get a halo and a harp and you're a Captain Cool if you, you know, like, have been killing people for 20 years as a hitman or something. I think you still wear that. I think you pretty much have that same personality, good or bad. So, yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, it was probably human.
Okay. Tell me more of the accounts, more of the experiences that people have had that you've documented in your book or that you've heard of with the asylum.
Well, you know, like I said, I've spoken a lot with, and I'm always very cautious with my sources just due to the fact that, you know, they don't tell me names. They don't really tell me anything that would connect with a person. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always obviously cautious too, you know, if they're going, like, well, hey, you know, we use this kind of card to get into whatever ward and stuff, you know, even if they happen to just go, oh, yeah, I had to use my blank, blank card to get into, I'm like, I don't even need to know that, but sure. Okay. But, you know, a lot of those people are either retired or moved on. I have some that are still there that have gave me information, but they're very, very careful with it because it's kind of like at the penitentiary, and it may be like other institutions too. It's just they're very compartmentalized and they want a very tight ship. They don't want any kind of, in their eyes, people talking smack about the place, which, you know, that's not anything they're doing. If a place is haunted, it's not necessarily their fault. It is what it is. But what I had was, you know, mainly, like I said, retired and previous employees. I've even spoke to people that were there, not for necessarily a mental issue, but someone who was, say, recovering from maybe like an opiate addiction or a painkiller, you know, due to after a surgery or something like that, and they developed an addiction to medication. One story, there was a lady, actually know this lady, grew up with this lady, and family's a very level-headed, hardworking, you know, for what it's worth, Christian people. And she opened up to me once we were talking about this and said, you know, I've never told anybody about this. And I said, but, you know, and she asked me, how am I writing my book? And I kind of told her, this is people. This is a story of people. It's not, you know, Hollywood sensationalized over the top. You know, if there's some gnarly stuff, it just happened. And she said, well, look, I was here and I was in a room. And the first few days, you deal with a lot of different stuff. And some of the things you can deal with is hallucinations and things like that. And I said, okay. And she said, well, this was well into a week or so of her treatment. And had been doing better. And I said, okay, well, what happened? I said, well, I was starting to deal with a presence. I said, like a visible standing entity. No, it wasn't like that. It said, it only come at night. I said, okay. And I said, how did it come to you? He said, well, it kind of went from shadow to shadow. I said, well, what do you mean? It's like it would be doing activity, sort of a shimmery, like darker than dark type image, and then it would sort of thin out and then reappear in another shadow over here. I said, so it didn't like move across the room. I said, no, which was really strange to me because usually you hear something like, well, the shadow moved throughout the room or moved across the wall or rose out of the floor. This thing kind of like entered and exited through shadows, almost like, I don't know how much you've done on like shadow people and stuff like that, but it kind of had a shadow people quality to it, but it was much darker. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, what happened? I said, well, it just kind of went on, and I would mention to this and that, and they said, well, you know, we'll make sure to get you a new light and do this and that, and they would try to do whatever. And I said, well, this is the room we have right now. We can't move you right now. You know, they checked the room out. There's no critters. There's no anything. There's nobody able to get in and out of the room but staff, and it's, you know, and the halls are on cameras. So anyway, this continued and started having sensations of things traveling across like her legs, something kind of like, how to describe it, almost like real gently moving their palm down like past your ear, down your chin, like maybe across your collarbone, just in a kind of borderline inappropriate. It wasn't sexual, but it was very intrusive, and it was very much like a I own you kind of thing. like, oh, look, I got a new toy. It was really uncomfortable for it. And I was like, well, what happened? Did you get up? You know, what happened? She says, well, what would happen is I couldn't move. And she was paralyzed. And I was like, oh, my God. And I said, well, how often does this happen? I said, well, it happened 2 or 3 nights. I said, well, tell me what happened last night. She said, each night it would become stronger. The room would become colder. Each time it was a little bit colder, a little bit more intense. And I said, well, what happened the third night? Something was on the bed, like around me. It's almost like it had like a leg or an arm or something, kind of half where my knees are at in the middle. One on either side of my hip, and then two above my shoulders, like it pinned me. And she said, but then you could kind of see an outline of, it was humanoid, but it wasn't human. The figure, the didn't have features, and the body was very distorted, almost like you had someone had fallen off a cliff and you try to put them back together, they're not going to look right. Like, you've ever seen somebody with a broken neck that doesn't set right?
Sure.
It's just like they rehealed and it didn't heal right. Well, this person or whatever this thing was draining her. She could feel like her essence being drained. And so she had actually was trying to call, you know, in the name of God and all this and that. Well, someone had actually come in and turned the light on, I guess, to check her or do whatever. And it was instant. Bam. It was gone. And I was like, that's crazy. That's an insane story. So I'm like, do you mind if I use it? She said, that's not it. And I said, there's more. I said, yeah. So I said, well, what happened? I said, I was in the processes of finally possibly getting moved. And they said, well, we'll have to see how quick we can get you in here. She said she was standing in her doorway, and she was mad. She was angry at this thing. And she kind of just said under your breath, you know, gee dang you. You know, I don't want to say the words. And, you know, said, you know, I hope you're right in here, you know, thinking she's getting out of there. She said she was physically lifted and pushed back. Not like you've tripped, not like you stumble back, like she was picked up and slammed and held against the wall. And I said, okay, who all was around? Said, at the time, says, there was another staff member that was on there, which they, and like I said, there should be cameras. It should be there, which I can't get it. I've tried to speak to people. I can't get the film because it's got people on it. I said, but there were other people that saw this. And she said, yes. And I've tried to speak to that individual. They didn't say it didn't happen, but they just said that's something they're not comfortable talking about. It was one of those, like, not like, well, I can't really get into this. It's just like, I do not feel comfortable speaking of this. And it was just that flat. And the person was very extremely personable and open. But once I hit that, I could tell I really hit a nerve. It was basically what wasn't said. Mm-hmm. That really gave it validity. And I'm just like, wow. And I know this lady now, she's a mother, very active in the community and doing fine. She said, but that moment, it's the closest to something what she would consider demonic, which I would say that was probably pretty close to something demonic if you want to categorize it.
That concludes part one of our interview with Steve Asher about the Western State Lunatic Asylum. In part two, we'll ask Steve, how would the staff explain all of these unexplained encounters? Encounters not only with the staff, but with patients of the hospital. Also, what's the most troubling story Steve has uncovered about the Western State Lunatic Asylum? And does he think that people who are suffering from these illnesses may also be the target to be tormented by dark forces from the other side? And have any of the patients or staff had similar encounters, maybe with the same spirit of sorts, at different times at the Western State Lunatic Asylum? All that and more in part two of our interview, which you can listen to when you go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and click on the Patreon link, or go directly to patreon.com/thegravetalks and support our show by becoming a gravekeeper. When you do that, for $5 a month, you'll have access to part two of all of our episodes, as well as advance access to every single episode we create, oftentimes weeks or months before they are publicly released. Keep our show on the air and enjoy all of those extras for only $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.